Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. New changes in voter laws enacted in state legislatures with Republican majorities are tightening up the path to the American voting booth. Cleaning it up, say sponsors. Barricading it, say critics, who charge the GOP with trying to win through restrictions what they might not in a free vote. With the 2012 presidential election right around the corner, this is not an academic exercise. The stakes are high. This hour on Point, the wave of new restrictions on American voting. A special welcome today to our newest listeners on KUHF in Houston, Texas. It is great to have you with us. We're going to hear in this hour from right, left, and center, and before we're done, from the national president of the League of Women Voters, who just folded voter registration efforts in Florida, saying it's been made too difficult by new law. Joining me first today from New York is Ari Berman, fellow at the Nation Institute, author of Herding Donkeys. His article for Rolling Stone magazine is The GOP War on Voting. Ari, thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
What's the outline? What are the categories of restriction that you see coming in and where?
Sure. So since the 2010 election, 38 states introduced legislation, and legislation was passed in a dozen states controlled by Republicans, I believe, to impede access to the ballot at every step of the electoral process. So there's really four prongs to what I termed the GOP war on voting. The first is cracking down on voter registration. You have three states, Kansas, Tennessee, and Alabama, now requiring proof of citizenship for registered voters. You have Florida and Texas making it harder for third-party groups like the League of Women Voters to register new voters. They've had to suspend their voter registration drives. As a result, you had Maine repeal Election Day voter registration, which had been on the books since 1973. So that's number one, voter registration. Number two is cutting back on early voting. You had five states, including crucial swing states like Ohio and Florida, cut back their early voting times pretty significantly, including banning voting on Sunday before the election when black churches historically mobilize their constituents. The third and I think most important prong in the war on voting has been the fact that six states controlled by Republican governors are now requiring photo IDs, government-issued photo IDs, to cast a ballot. And people don't realize, and I'm sure we'll talk about this more, that 10% of U.S. citizens don't have that ID, including 18% of young voters and 25% of African-American voters. And the last thing that these states are doing is in two states, Florida and Iowa, they're disenfranchising previously eligible ex-felons, nonviolent ex-felons who serve their time and would be eligible to vote are now unable to vote. So those are the four prongs in the war on voting.
I'm trying to get a sense of the scale here. In total, how much of the country is affected by this at this point? I mean, some of the things you're describing have happened in just a couple of states, other things in half a dozen states. How much of the country has seen tightening, Ari?
It's very sweeping. The Brennan Center for Justice just put out a report that said 5 million voters could be significantly impacted by these new laws. That includes 60% of the winning margin for the Electoral College. So 60% of the 270 votes needed, they have passed this restrictive form of legislation. So it's very sweeping. It amounts, I believe, to the most wholesale rewriting of our election laws since the passage of the Voting Rights Act. It was done very quietly by Republicans after the 2010 election when they had these huge majorities. And it's only now that there's starting to be scrutiny about the passage of all these laws in a dozen different states.
What do you say to those who say, well, why not be clear about who's voting? Why not be sure that they're American citizens? After all, that's who the vote is for. That they are who they say they are. Voter ID provides that. What's the problem?
Sure. Well, there's a few different problems. Number one, it's absolutely unnecessary. There's no problem in American legislation or in American elections that actually necessitates this sort of laws being passed. But if you look, for example, at the voter ID piece, because I get asked this all the time, mm-hmm. I mean, the first thing is that the number of people who don't have the legislation, I mentioned it earlier, 10% of voters, including 18% of young voters and 25% of African Americans, these are likely to be people that are young voters, they're students, they're minorities, they are low-income voters. These are people that tend to vote for Democrats, and it's no coincidence, I believe, that the laws are being passed by Republicans.
Now, I think you misspoke there. What is it that they don't have? They wouldn't have a driver's license, for example?
They wouldn't have a driver's license, yes, for example. So it's not just the fact that people don't have these IDs, but then you have to look at how the laws are written. And I think the laws are written in a way that's clearly discriminatory. For example, in Texas, you can vote with a handgun permit, but you can't vote with a student ID. In Wisconsin, for example, they've written the law in such a way that every student ID in the state is now ineligible. So you have 242,000 students that are unable to vote with that ID. And then the laws are implemented in a way that will also be restrictive. So the states have to offer free ID. But for the example, in South Carolina, to be able to get that free ID, you have to provide some other proof of ID. So that might be a birth certificate or a passport. Those cost money. And so it's being called a stepsister of the poll tax. Remember, barriers, things that cost money, have been in the past construed as a poll tax. So there's a history here that we have to be very aware of. And the third thing is, it's not buying prescription drugs. Voting is one of the most basic constitutional rights. It's mentioned in two articles and 10 amendments to the Constitution. We have a long history in this country of suppressing the right to vote through things like poll taxes and literacy tests. So anytime someone talks about protecting the sanctity of American elections, we have to be very careful about who will actually be affected by it, because we have a long history of preventing access to the ballot under the guise of so-called voter fraud in this country.
Now you're not just saying that this will make it tougher to just step up and vote. Now, obviously, you know, these one by one, these things would do that. But you're calling it, right in the headline, a GOP war on voting. And how do you make that case? I mean, this is passed.
Tom, I think you just have to look at the facts at hand. These laws are passed overwhelmingly by Republicans. We haven't seen in many, many election cycles any sort of attempt like we've seen since the 2010 election. We've seen a wholesale rewriting of the nation's election laws in a dozen states, 38 states controlled, where Republicans in 38 states have introduced this kind of legislation. So if you go down and you look at who will be affected, who is pushing the legislation, which party will benefit, it's clear to me that Republicans are introducing this legislation, passing this legislation, and primarily Democratic-leaning voters will be the ones affected by these new laws.
You're right. It's a widespread deliberate effort that could prevent millions of mostly Democratic voters, including students, minorities, immigrants, ex-convicts, and the elderly, from casting ballots in 2012. Have these restrictions passed in any state where there's not a Republican majority in the state legislature, Ari?
The only state is Rhode Island, which passed a looser form of photo ID. So there, for example, you can vote with an electricity bill, I believe, something that's less restrictive. You don't have to have a government-issued photo ID. So I don't believe that's bad. That's as bad. And you can also vote with a provisional ballot if you don't have that form of ID. So it's a looser restriction. But overwhelmingly, these laws are passed by Republicans. There was a stat I heard that for the photo ID bills, the legislation, 98% of the votes for voter ID have come from Republicans, and 98% of the votes against voter ID have come from Democrats.
Now, you go further, and in your piece, you say that it's a systematic campaign, you write, orchestrated by the American Legislative Exchange Council and funded in part by David and Charles Koch, the billionaire brothers who bankrolled the Tea Party. Now, but you don't say much more about how, you know, about your proof for that. We reached out to the American Legislative Exchange Council. We invited them on the show. They declined. In their decline, though, they said, Ari, just quoting here to you from them, they said voter ID is not a focus of their initiatives. Said we do have model legislation out there on it, but quoting them here, we have no resources devoted to the issue and are not at the forefront of it.
Well, that's an interesting denial, considering the fact that the American Legislative Exchange Council, otherwise known as ALEC, which is a conservative advocacy group made up of state legislators, in five of the states that passed voter ID legislation, the co-sponsors were members of ALEC, number one. Secondly, after the 2008 election, ALEC drafted mock voter ID legislation, and that became the basis for legislation that was introduced in Texas, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. So ALEC's footprints are all over this, and they're all over this, number one, in a technical sense of state legislators co-sponsoring and providing the mock legislation, but I think also in a philosophical sense, because there's a great quote from Paul Weyrich, a very influential Christian right activist who founded ALEC, and he said in 1980, he said, "I don't want everybody to vote." That was his quote. He said, "Our leverage in the elections, Republicans, goes up as the voting populace goes down, meaning that, generally speaking, when more people turn out, Democrats do better. When fewer people turn out, Republicans do better. And I believe that is the philosophical basis for all these laws we've seen introduced in the since the 2010 election.
Is this a philosophical debate in the end, or are there enough votes and enough obstacles in the path potentially here of certain American voters to change outcomes in 2012 voting?
It could absolutely change outcomes. If you look, for example, 5 million impacted voters, that's larger than the margin of victory in either the 2000 or the 2004 election. If you look at a state-by-state basis, we know, for example, a state like Florida was decided by 537 votes in the 2000 election. We've seen three major changes in Florida, as I mentioned, making it harder to register to vote, cutting back on early voting, and disenfranchising ex-felons. We could easily see more than 537 people disenfranchised in a state like Florida. We know the 2012 election is going to be very, very very close. And that's why these laws are so alarming. And I should say, Tom, that I believe that voting should be a nonpartisan issue. And I believe one of the sad things that has come out of all these laws is they've politicized something that both parties essentially should be working to uphold, which is trying to make it as easy as possible for as many people to vote.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about a new wave of restrictions on who can vote and how. Republicans say it's just cleanup time. Democrats say it's a war on voting. Ari Berman is with us. He wrote the big story for Rolling Stone. His is called The GOP War on Voting. We're going to hear from someone who's been pushing tighter controls on voting, also from opponents to that, and from the national president of the League of Women Voters. Ari Berman mentioned Paul Ryrick, who's been a guest on our show back in 1980, the conservative political activist co-founder of the Heritage Foundation, spoke to a gathering of evangelical leaders about his stance on voting.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome, good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
All the way back in 1980, Ari Berman says it's happening again right now. Bill Clinton spoke to this much more recently, just over the summer at the Campus Progress Convention in Washington. This was in July. Here's the president talking about what he said was a national effort to limit the voting franchise.
I can't help thinking, since we just celebrated the 4th of July and we're supposed to be a country dedicated to liberty, that one of the most pervasive political movements going on outside Washington today is the disciplined, passionate, determined effort of Republican governors and legislators to keep most of you from voting next time. There has never been in my lifetime, since we got rid of the poll tax and all the other Jim Crow burdens on voting, the determined effort to limit the franchise that we see today.
Former President Bill Clinton over the summer. Let's go to our guest, Jason Torchinsky joins us right now from Washington. He's a partner at the law firm Holtzman Vogel, former counsel to the Civil Rights Division at the U.S. Department of Justice under President George W. Bush. We'll talk about that. Deputy General Counsel to the 04 Bush-Cheney Campaign and Inaugural Committee. Jason Torchinsky, thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And with us from Annapolis, Maryland, Jamie Raskin, Director of the Law and Government Program at American University's Washington College of Law, teaches constitutional law. Jamie Raskin, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure to be with you, Tom.
Jason Torchinsky, there's the former president saying that we are in the midst of a disciplined, passionate, determined effort of Republican governors and legislators to keep most of you from voting next time. What do you say?
I clearly don't agree with him. I think what you're seeing is an effort to help ensure the integrity of elections nationwide, and an issue that has been sort of lingering, particularly since the 2000 election. And I think that the efforts that you're seeing are an effort to help ensure integrity. When you look around, there have been a whole series of voting problems that have been identified, and these laws are an attempt to respond to those problems.
Do you see a concerted Republican effort to push back against potential Democratic voters?
You know, I don't think that these efforts by these legislators in these states is really to, you know, stop Democrats from voting. I think it really is an attempt to ensure integrity of the elections.
How do you then explain that it's they're passing in states overwhelmingly with Republican majorities, not Democratic?
Well, Democrats have, I mean, sort of sponsored by a bunch of groups on the left, beginning with the Brennan Center. There have been just an active campaign to oppose these kinds of laws when there's no real evidence of it. You know, when you look at the Rhode Island law, it was introduced by an African-American Democrat legislator. It was signed by an independent governor. When you look at actual turnout in Georgia and Indiana after the voter ID law passed, turnout went up dramatically among all voters. And in particular in Georgia, turnout went up among African-American voters. So this claim out there by the Brennan Center that's been echoed by a lot of folks on the left that somehow this is an attempt to quote unquote disenfranchise a particular group of voters, I just don't think it bears out in the facts.
Jamie Raskin at American University, do you see a voting fraud problem of significant scale in this country, one that requires a pushback and tightening up of significant scale?
Well, I mean, that's the curious thing about the whole push to impose these photo ID laws. There are a minuscule number of cases that can be found of people impersonating others to go and vote. I mean, that essentially doesn't happen. You've got a much greater chance of getting struck by lightning. I mean, the fact of the matter is we saw in the 2000 presidential election, the people who steal elections in America are the people who run elections, not a handful of voters who might go out and try to impersonate somebody else.
What do you mean by that, Jamie? What do you mean by
Well, if you look at what Katherine Harris did, for example, spending hundreds of thousands of dollars of taxpayer money in Florida to set up a private contract with a consultant to go out and purge the voter list where there's specific documentary evidence that she said purge names that are similar to those of people who are convicted felons. And, of course, that's a whole other issue about whether people who've done good time and gotten out should be disenfranchised at all. But in any way, in Florida, they went beyond the core of people who actually had been convicted to people whose names may have resembled them and purged them from the rolls. I mean, that's how elections are really stolen in America, not by virtue of somebody dressing up as somebody else and going to vote. I mean, they just can't find cases of that. But look, I mean, we're looking at an historical struggle. We know that when the country began, we were not anything resembling a full universal democracy. We were a slave republic of Christian white male property owners in the states. And it's only been through democratic struggle that we've dismantled the property, the wealth, the race, the gender, the poll taxes, the literacy tests, all of these restrictions on voting. But it's a constant seesaw battle, and we're just seeing the exact same thing playing out for the 2012 election.
And what do you say to those in the Republican Party or elsewhere, Jamie Raskin, who say, look, all we're asking is for people to show us who they are at the polls, be American citizens, not be felons. I don't know. You can argue about that, whether felons who have done their time should be able to vote. But what about just look at voter ID and proof of citizenship? Is that too much to ask?
You know, but my dad, who served in the Kennedy administration, has been a U.S. citizen his entire life, doesn't have a driver's license anymore because he's blind in one eye. So if he were subject to one of these laws, he would suddenly have to go out and find another form of photo ID. And so you're just raising the cost and the burdens of voting. You're going to create much longer lines at the polls with people checking the IDs like you're carding people at a bar. And there's no reason to do any of this. So, you know, look, if you want to know what's really going on, check out what's happening in Pennsylvania, where the Republicans are moving to change the way that the Electoral College votes are apportioned by saying we'll do it by congressional district rather than doing it statewide because they know that Pennsylvania is a blue state. I mean, it's not one thing I disagree with is it's not so much to, you know, wage a war on voting. It's to win the election. And if they need to wage battles on voting, they will in different parts of the country. And in other states, they'll say we're going to change the way that we award Electoral Colleges. So they're using every possible strategic maneuver in order to win.
It was an issue this weekend in Washington where the new Martin Luther King Jr. statue was formally dedicated. Al Sharpton was there saying that proposed changes to voting laws in a lot of states now would, in his view, take the vote away from people who were cast out and cast back.
When you look at the fact that people are talking about states' rights again, they want to take away our vote in 34 states, talking about voter ID, talking about ending early registration, ending early voting. They want to honor Dr. King and revoke the Voting Rights Act at the same time. You can't kill the Voting Rights Act and honor Dr. King.
Big kind of accusation there from Al Sharpton over the weekend. Jamie Raskin, Jason Torchinsky, Ari Berman, please stand by. Lots of callers here. Charleston, South Carolina, Michael's calling. Hi, Michael. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, hey. I just express a little bit of disappointment in what's going on here with this voter ID issue. I think the most important thing in America is to be able to vote and have an honest election. And if you can't honestly prove that you are who you are when you go to vote, then really the people that are voting are being disenfranchised in respect to their vote, because you don't know the other votes are being honest or not, because the people could be voting early and vote often, as it said in Chicago. And, you know, in our state, we're having voter ID laws, and the ACLU is getting involved in a lawsuit now, and I think it's just ridiculous. When I go to get a voter registration card, which I need to vote, I need to show ID. When I go to do various other things in society, I need to show ID. And why is there a big issue about this, that you should be who you say you are when you go to vote?
Be who you say you are, show your ID, and no problem. Ari Berman, what do you say to Michael's perspective from Charleston?
Sure. Well, the first thing I would say to Michael is the fact that we've shown over and over and over that people don't have these IDs, that if you look at the numbers, you have a situation in South Carolina where upwards of 200,000 eligible voters don't have this ID. In a state like Texas, 600,000 registered voters don't have that ID. So these are people that participate in the political process that now have an additional and unnecessary barrier. In South Carolina, for example, to be able to get that free ID now, you need, as I said earlier, some sort of documentation, a passport or a birth certificate to prove who you are. Many elderly black voters in South Carolina who were born at home in the segregated South, they don't have access to that documentation. They might now have to go to family court in order to prove who they are just to be able to vote. In a state with a long history of disenfranchising citizens on the basis of race or other qualifications, saying that they can't vote. So it's a totally unnecessary barrier. And to go back to this voter fraud thing, it really is a phantom menace. The Justice Department under George W. Bush made prosecuting voter fraud a top priority, but between 2002 and 2007, when 300 million votes were cast, they failed to prosecute a single person for impersonating an eligible voter. And they convicted only 86 people out of 300 million votes for so-called voter fraud. And most of those people were simply immigrants or former felons who didn't even realize they were ineligible to vote. So there's never been any proven instance of a conspiracy in terms of voter fraud to steal an election in modern American history.
That doesn't seem like a big number out of 300 million. Jason, I'll bring that to you, but let me get a call right here first. Nate in Des Moines, Iowa. Nate, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I was wondering that in light of the Citizens United case also, and in light of these new restrictions on voting, does it seem like there's more going to be more corporate influence in elections now that, Republicans are generally more more favorable to corporations, and the Citizens United case now lets them spend as much as they want to? Is it more of a disenfranchisement now that you're going to suppress more of the minority vote here?
Jason, I'll bring that to you. Do you expect that these would have the net effect of suppressing a minority vote, a student vote, an elderly vote? And you hear the further question from our caller in Iowa, you know, is this put it together with Citizens United? Do you end up with a more corporate influence?
You know, I think there's been way more hype than reality from the left about voter ID. You know, there was an American University survey of voters in Maryland, Indiana, and Mississippi that showed that less than one half of 1% of registered voters lacked a government-issued photo ID. There was a University of Missouri study of Indiana that showed turnout up 2% over in the first election after ID went into effect. And the Census Bureau showed that 65% of African Americans of voting age population voted in 2008 versus 54% of black Americans of voting age population who voted in 2004. So you just look at the results, the actual effect of this law in Georgia, and you see that it actually didn't hurt African American turnout. In fact, African American turnout increased between the last presidential election before voter ID and the most recent presidential election since voter ID.
Jamie Raskin, a significant bump in the road for potential voters or not? You hear Jason and Ari disagreeing on that.
Well, of course, it comes down to which voters you're talking about. I mean, even if you say it's as low as a half of 1%, although I've seen studies showing that it's closer to 5 or 6%, but even if it's one half of 1% and say you're talking about, you know, 400 million people, you're talking about a couple million people who aren't going to have the right ID to go out there, and those are overwhelmingly going to be older voters, poor voters who don't have cars and don't drive, and disproportionately minority. But you know, the real question is, do we see voting as a fundamental right and attribute of citizenship that should be protected and promoted, or do we want to pile on a series of restrictions and obstacles that make it more difficult for people to get to the polls? And, you know, I'm not moved by cherry-picking the evidence of showing how there's an increase of voting in one state that had it for one election, when we know the reality is on the ground that it causes lots of difficulties for people and discourages and deters people from the polls.
Let's go to Chris in Hollis, Maine. Chris, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. It's interesting. The Maine instituted the law to block voter day registration. They rolled it back 2 days, 2 business days. But their own Republican, our attorney general, investigated this phantom fraud, and they came up with one violation. It ended up being a Republican official who was registered in two towns. So, I mean, where's the fraud? And all in all, I just think it's an infringement on constitutional right to vote.
Chris, I appreciate your call. Jason Tarczynski, what about it? We look back to this big U.S. Election Assistant Commission investigation into this back in 2006. They talked to a whole lot of people in this neck of the woods. And I'm reading here from that report, and it cites you. It says, Jason Tarczynski from the American Center for Voting Rights is the only interviewee who believes that polling place fraud is widespread and among the most significant problems in the system. Are you an outlier, Jason? They say you are.
Well, I mean, I disagree. I mean, I think that ensuring the integrity of elections is one of the most important things we can do. In other words, if you're casting votes and there's illegal votes being cast, your vote is being diluted.
But you're just asserting that quantity of illegal voting or fraud going on, that this big study says you're the only one who asserted that. What does that say to you?
Well, you know, I don't know who else they talk to, but, you know.
Oh, we can name them. There's a lot. I mean, you can find the report.
That was a huge bipartisan report. They interviewed many, many people, Jason, and you were the only outlier.
Well, look, I believe that voter fraud is a problem in this country, and I believe that these laws are a rational response. I mean, look, even the Supreme Court has said, you know, Justice Stevens, in upholding the Indiana voter ID law, said not only is the risk of voter fraud real, but that it could affect the outcome of close elections. So I do believe that ensuring the integrity of the vote is key to making sure that our elections are actually won by who they say they're won by. I mean, if you go back to 1996 in the Dornan Sanchez recount, you know, they stopped. It was a 900 vote difference. They stopped the recount, or they stopped the investigation when they got up to 684 non-citizens who had voted. Well, okay, if they had kept going, you know, would they have found enough non-citizens who had voted might have made a difference in the election?
I get it, and it's you can cite the instances. I guess the issue overall is it weighty enough to put obstacles in front of Americans heading to the polls? Jamie Raskin, you follow this. We've got a lot more states with legislation on the table. Do you see more of this coming?
Yeah, it's constant. I mean, where they're able to enact it, they will. I mean, you know, the big game, though, is really at the Electoral College level, finding the blue states where there are now Republican majorities in the legislature, and to try to redraw the methods of apportioning Electoral College votes. It's also happening with redistricting. I mean, if you take North Carolina, which is a state that was won by President Obama in 2008. There are now 10 majority Republican districts that have been drawn to 3 majority Democratic. So,
of course, very narrowly won in 2008. Jamie Raskin at American University's Washington College of Law, thank you for joining us. And Jason Tarczynski at Holtzman Vogel, thanks to each of you. Ari Berman, please stand by. When we come back, we'll talk with the national president of the League of Women Voters on this issue. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about a wave of new restrictions on who can vote. Ari Berman is with us. He's written a big story for Rolling Stone called The GOP War on Voting. You can read it at our website, onpointradio.org. And speaking of Dr. Martin Luther King, his statue unveiled formally celebrated this weekend in Washington, D.C. He talked a lot, of course, about voting and voting rights. Here he was. This was back in 1966, a year after President Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act, talking about the atmosphere around voting.
This voting rights bill came into being to end not only discrimination in its overt expressions in voter registration, but also to remove the atmosphere for intimidation, for economic reprisals, and for the creation of fear that caused people not to vote. And one of the things we have found is that when you have federal registrars, many more Negroes go out to register because they see a different atmosphere and they are not overarched or undergirded with fear.
Dr. Martin Luther King, 1966, warning against an atmosphere that would push people away from the polls. All kinds of response at our website and beyond here. Worried for the country, says, sees no problem in the new ID and so on. He says, who could be against fair, fraud-free elections? Here's another from Kelly who says, I'd like to think as an idealist. This is simply a matter of cleanup. She goes on, I believe I've seen studies indicating that in states that have passed voter ID laws, there is little to no real issue with voter fraud. We'll have Elizabeth McNamara with us in just a moment. A couple of calls. First, Karen in Waynesboro, Tennessee. Thanks for calling, Karen. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
In Tennessee, we have these new restrictive voter ID laws, and yet in our legislature, in a bipartisanly passed a law requiring paper ballots,
mm-hmm.
and on all the for all the elections, and they haven't obeyed their own laws, and yet they have put burdens on the voters of this state. And this is from a party that says they want to get government off our back.
Karen, I see here that you've worked in election offices.
Yes.
What have you seen?
I've seen a lot of, well, in Tennessee, when you're over 60, you don't have to have a picture. I'm not sure, it's maybe a little older than 60, but
mm-hmm.
elderly people don't have to have a picture on their driver's license.
Right.
So there are a lot of elderly people who don't have pictures on their voter ID. And we don't have a place to get a free government-issued photo ID in our county that I'm aware of.
So when they come in to vote, these older Tennessee voters, and they don't have a photo ID from the government that fills the obligation, what happens? What do they tend to do?
Well, it's kind of odd because we're in a county where everybody knows everybody. So people mm-hmm. at the polls would be in a position. We haven't had an election since this law has been passed.
Mm-hmm.
But people at the polls will be in a position of turning away people that they know. It could be their own grandmother, and to strictly obey that law if she doesn't have a picture ID.
What do you think it might mean for turnout? You work in the voting site there. Do you think people may just not bother to vote?
Yes, I do. I've had people say, well, I just got my driver's license. I'm not going back there to get a picture. I just won't vote.
Karen, I appreciate your call there from Waynesboro. Let me get one more from Cheryl in Waterloo, Iowa. Cheryl, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a comment and a question.
Mm-hmm.
My comment is that, just kind of harkening back to what you were talking about earlier, when they require having an ID, then each state should, at that point, it should be free because you're essentially charging someone money for the ID, and then, therefore you're charging someone money to vote. I think it's just outright against our constitutional rights to vote. The second thing that I wanted to ask was a question about felon voting rights, because they had mentioned that earlier.
Yes.
And they have worked so hard in Iowa to really sort of give that back. And I'm a transplant Iowan. I've never heard of it from any other states. I was wondering how that would affect, ex-felons being able to vote again. I have, the father of my children would be, this would be the year it would be his first time ever being able to vote since, he's gotten all of his stuff off paper and he's really looking forward to it. And that's, I guess I'll just take my question off the air.
So he's got a felony in his background, but he's cleared that, done his time, and he's ready to vote. And Iowa's one of the states that's tightened up. Let me take that to Ari Berman. Ari, it's what, Florida and Iowa that have made it substantially more difficult or sometimes impossible for people with past felony convictions to vote, Ari?
Yeah, these are new restrictions that the Republican governors in both states put in place. In Iowa, after you've served your time, if you're an ex-felon, you now have to petition the state in order to be able to get your right to vote back. And in Florida, there's a very lengthy process. It could take 5 to 7 years for ex-felons to be able to get their right to vote. So Florida and Iowa now join Kentucky and Virginia as the only states with this sort of very, very strict restriction, where essentially ex-felons are prohibited from voting in the next election, even if they've served their time.
Ari, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Atlanta, Georgia, Elizabeth McNamara. She's national president of the League of Women Voters, has worked with the League since 1983. Elizabeth McNamara, we're very grateful to you for taking time to be with us today. Thanks so much for coming on.
Well, hello, Tom, and I'm very glad to be on the show.
Could you go straight to Florida with us for a minute? Because that's what first got, I mean, we've been watching this for a while, but it really got our attention when recently your Florida operations, as I understand it, they've suspended their what's typically ongoing voter registration work because the new legislation there, they found too difficult to deal with. What happened there, Elizabeth?
Well, this is not the first time that the state of Florida has put restrictions on registration that have directly impacted third-party organizations like the League of Women Voters. We were able to sue the state of Florida the last time this sort of legislation passed and successfully settle out that lawsuit such that the League was able to resume voter registration. This particular bill, which passed this year in the Florida legislature, it puts even more restrictions and much tighter restrictions on voter registration. A lot of red tape, a lot of regulation as to who can register voters or how third-party registrars qualify or third-party groups like the League qualify. And then also, very importantly, have such a restrictive requirement on how soon you have to turn those registration forms around that the League has decided in Florida very publicly to discontinue voter registration efforts in that state, which is not to say that the League is going to just roll over and not do anything about this, but simply that this is so burdensome. These regulations are so burdensome that organizations like the League are not going to be able, without some modification or something happening, to be able to register voters in the state of Florida.
Your executive director there, Jessica Lowe Miner, said that, you know, told us that we don't have the resources to comply with this law. It is so onerous. It places a lot of stress on voters. Does this line up with the sort of ideals of American democracy to make registering voters difficult?
Well, it certainly does not in our experience. And, of course, the League has got a 90-year history of working very hard to open up the process to all voters. Remember that we came directly out of the suffrage movement. We know historically firsthand how it is, you know, what it's like to suddenly be have the right to vote and then have to fight state by state in order to get around restrictions on registering and voting. So this is something that is very personal to the League. And you know, after seeing for the last half of the 21st century real progress made on encouraging more and more folks to go to the polls, on having a real emphasis on people turning out to vote, the message that this legislation sends is probably the most concerning for the League. The idea that we are suddenly in an atmosphere where people are being discouraged by laws, by all of these restrictions, perhaps from going to the polls, makes our work an awful lot more difficult.
Elizabeth McNamara, please stand by. We've got lots of listeners calling in here. Horace in Columbia, South Carolina. Horace, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hello, Tom. How you doing?
Pretty well.
I want to address the gentleman that was on earlier about people being able to get the ID. Just to give an example of myself. Okay, I live in a rural area right outside of Columbia. As far as driving time, it takes me about, I guess, about 15, 20 minutes if the traffic's good. But, you know, but I live in an area where there's not any public transportation. My car has been down for basically in the shop being repaired for maybe about a month now.
Yep.
I have to go to get the Social Security because I don't have anyone to take me there. Like I said, I'm 65 years old, ex-Vietnam vet. I'm in excellent health. But, you know, I have to get down there and take care of business. But because I don't have anyone to take me there,
yep,
it's basically been frustrating to me. So I can understand someone who is, you know, disabled in any way, shape, form, or fashion about them getting someplace to pick up new you know,
just to get the card.
To have before.
Yeah, just to get to the office and get the card. Horace, I've got it. I mean, you speak directly to the problem on that side. You know, if you're in the full flush of health and driving around, you've got an office right there, maybe it's not such a big deal. But what about all those people for whom just getting these required documents is a hurdle in itself? Ari Berman, you could see how Horace or somebody like you might easily stay home. And you've written about where these offices are and where they are not. Who has easy access and who does not, Ari?
Well, absolutely. If you look at the people that are going to have a harder time getting the IDs and the amount of hoops that they're going to have to jump through to get them, I mean, it is going to be lower income voters. It is going to be minority voters. It is going to be people with disabilities. It is going to be more elderly voters. Now, these aren't uniformly people that will vote for Democratic candidates, but taken as a whole, they are more likely to vote for Democrats than they are to vote for Republicans. And we're putting in place all these barriers that I believe are just completely unnecessary. There's nothing to justify the fact that it's so difficult now to be able to vote. And I believe a lot of people that are kind of on the margins, there's a bad economy right now. They're not that crazy about Barack Obama or Mitt Romney, whoever the Republican nominee is, and they see all these new registrations and they think to themselves, why bother? I'm just not going to vote. And it's hard to quantify. It's hard to put a number on how many people that will be. But it is very discouraging from a small D democratic process standpoint that we're making it so much difficult for people to vote.
Let's get a call from Montreal, Canada, across the border. Brian, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I wanted just to relate. We've gone through two continent-wide elections in this country under the kinds of rules you've been describing today, with the single exception of prisoner votes, because in Canada, prisoners even in jail have voting rights.
But Canada has experience with the other kind of new requirements and restrictions we're talking about here. What did you see in that, Brian?
Over two nationwide elections, slowly and steadily, the Conservative government, for the first time in half a century, has the hammer lock on both chambers of our government. And my position as poll clerk in both those elections showed me that it mostly consisted of discriminating and making less attractive the voting experience unless you have a pocket full of cards. And that's a middle-class experience. Elderly people, homeless people, were systematically not able to prove their right to vote. And even if they could do it by going half an hour away, they said, I give up.
A little Canadian perspective there, and I appreciate that, Brian. Let me get one. Thank you very much for that call. One more. Harrisonburg, Virginia. Joe, you're on the air.
Tom, the right to vote is for the benefit of the government, because when people are feel disenfranchised, they will find a way to have their say anyways. That's what these Occupy Wall Street and Occupy D.C. are about.
So what, you think this is going to end up coming back to bite people if we don't have the country fully engaged in voting?
Amen.
Joe, we got it. Let me get one more. Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, you're on.
Hi. I think this is pretty much the last gasp of a dying party. The Republicans clearly see that their base are older white men. And let's be frank, the same thing that happened to any old white man, it's the same thing that happened to any old person on planet Earth. They die. And they see the Democratic Party is growing bigger and wider. They've managed to alienate every ethnic race, non-evangelical Christian in this country. So they figure this is a way to slow down their demise. But it's an inevitability. That they're going to go down just because of the pure numbers. 1 + 1 = 2. I don't care where you're from.
Carl, we got it. Of course, so you say, but there's a 2012 election right in front of us, and it's not so clear how that will go. One more. Mary in Nashville, Tennessee. Mary, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to say that when the law here was passed for photo ID, the only fraud case that was referenced for the need for this photo ID was fraud perpetrated by election workers. And they were caught and they were punished. So our system already works, so we really don't need these photo IDs. The second thing is I want to also echo what Ari said about the cost of the IDs. They're free here in Tennessee, but the cost comes in when people who don't have them have to get to the driver services center, or they have to gather the documents that they need. There's a woman named Dorothy Cooper, 96-year-old woman from Hamilton County near Chattanooga, who brought a stack of documents, including an original birth certificate, to driver service centers and was turned away. She still does, as far as I know, still does not have a photo ID. She's 96. She's been voting for 70 years. There's just no need for this law.
Mary, I appreciate your call. Elizabeth McNamara, what's the bottom line on this? League of Women Voters has been working on this kind of thing for a long time in a pretty straight-up, neutral, nonpartisan way. Does this amount to a cleanup or to vote suppression? How do you look at it?
Well, we definitely view it as voter suppression. Whatever the motivation, whatever the stated motivation, the integrity of the system, which is extremely important to the League of Women Voters, would be a lot better protected by spending the amount of money. And these are don't anybody get us wrong. This is a really expensive process of requiring folks to have voter ID, not just to the individuals, and that's unquestioned, but it's also an expensive new government program. This is a lot of regulation for almost no benefit from an integrity standpoint. That money would be a lot better spent on making sure that our election officials have the resources they need, making sure we've got well-trained and adequate numbers of poll workers, numbers of voting devices in all of our precincts. There's a lot that we could do that would make this process a lot more open and a lot and really ensure integrity. This is not the way to go, and the League will continue. We've been fighting these laws in every single state where they've come up, and we're going to continue to do so. But at the same time, we're going to be expending resources in all 50 states to make sure that every voter knows what they need when they go to the polls and that every voter has a fair opportunity to get there.
Well, the new laws are coming up fast and furious. We wish you good luck. Elizabeth McNamara, National President of the League of Women Voters, joining us today from Atlanta. Elizabeth, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
And Ari Berman, who wrote the big piece for Rolling Stone. Ari, it's terrific to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tom, for doing this.
Thanks for joining us today, and welcome, Houston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.